little man.
This is Bob Frelich, co-host of Thinking Clearly. With the election cycle for the 2024 presidential election beginning to ramp up, every once in a while, Julia and I will replay one of our previous episodes, an episode that reminds us of how important critical thinking is to our democracy. So here's the first of these, Thinking Clearly episode number 79, How Critical Thinking Can Make Us Better Citizens and Cure Our Ailing Democracy, with guest Timothy Redmond. This episode originally aired on February 2nd of this year. Enjoy. Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelich, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Bob.
Really looking forward to this conversation. And we've got a great guest all connected up, Julia.
Today's topic is a look at the effects of extreme political polarization and hyper-partisanship on our democratic process, and how critical thinking can make us better citizens.
And our guest, Timothy Redmond, has a PhD in political science and is an award-winning educator who currently teaches advanced placement U.S. government and politics, global history, and a number of elective courses, including critical thinking, in an age of information at Williamsville East High School in Amherst, New York. And in addition to his high school teaching schedule, Tim serves as the teacher training director at the Academy of Human Rights, and in his spare time keeps the beat as the drummer in the New York-based band Snapcase. But what brings Tim to Thinking Clearly is my having read his recently published, very well-written, well-documented, and timely book titled Political Tribalism in America, How Hyper-Partisanship Dumbs Down Democracy and How to Fix It, a book that examines the current nature of tribal politics, its effect on our democratic institutions, and what needs to be done to cure our ailing democracy. Tim Redmond, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hi, Bob. Hi, Julia. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. I guess we'll just jump right into our questions. As Bob mentioned, you'd recently published a book. Writing a book, getting published, being widely read, that is a major undertaking. What motivated you to take that on?
I've always had a really rabid interest in both politics and critical thinking. And that interest is largely driven by my aspiration that not only people live, but that we also live well. And I truly believe that when we get our thinking right, we can get our politics right. And when we get our politics right, we're more likely to live well. We're more likely to live longer, be healthier, be happier, be safer. And this is really why I went into education and became an educator. And it's also why I started to become an author too. I initially began writing a column for a local newspaper in the area just outside of Buffalo, New York. And it was always a column about critical thinking and politics. And the response to that column was wonderful. A lot of people would approach me or send emails talking about how much they appreciated the column and how it made them look at things in a different way. And so then I started writing some articles for some longer form articles for some magazines like Skeptic or Skeptical Inquirer. And one of the articles that I had published in Skeptic, I received an email from the author Guy Harrison, who has written several books on critical thinking. And I had read a bunch of his books. And, you know, all of a sudden I received an email from him and I was very excited and opened it up. And he had read one of my articles, very bluntly said, Tim, you need to write a book. And, you know, I had thought about it in passing, but never really dove into that type of project. And he was really supportive and encouraging and walked me through the process of what I would need to do and how to write up a book proposal and who I should send it to and so on. And was, you know, I would send my proposal to him and he'd make some suggestions and so on. And So I finally wrote up a proposal, sent it out to some publishers, and McFarland got back to me and said they wanted to publish it. And so then I went about writing it. And you're right, Julia, it's a long process. It's a time-consuming process, but I have a really strong support system, a wonderful family, and that was encouraging. And Guy was encouraging throughout the whole process and was able to finish it off. And here we are.
And what made you think that this was a timely space in what's happening in our country and in the world in general to get into the kinds of topics that you do in that book?
I think so much has changed with, I guess, from maybe, 2014 or so with social media and politics and the role that that's been playing in how we get our news and how we communicate with each other and the rise of quote unquote fake news or conspiracy theories and things of that nature. And a lot of that, so much of that revolves around politics and, my two interests being politics and critical thinking and a lot of the research that I had been just reading out of general interest up to that point on those sort of where those two topics came together. I just really felt that there was a need for a book that touched on these subjects. And there's a lot of books that talk about critical thinking and politics, but what I tried to do was put something together that just tried to trace the thought process and go step by step and how our thinking can be derailed by our partisan attachments. And there was so much great research that had been done really over decades on that topic, but it had never really been consolidated in one place and really done so for the general public. And these research projects and researchers had such an incredible impact on me and my thinking. And I just really wanted to share that. And when I started doing that column and started doing some of those articles and I received the feedback that I did, that's when I decided to give it a full book. And I'm happy that I did. I'm thrilled that I went through the process and had the support of all the people that I had. And I hope the book will be well received.
It was well received by me because I very much appreciate the documentation that you did in that book, citing very relevant research studies appropriately placed into the other ideas that you were communicating in that book. And I very much appreciate that. So I think it is a great book for the combination of critical thinking and political science. And one of the recurring themes in your book is the contrast between what you call the folk theory of democracy and the tribal theory of democracy. Why don't you bring us up to speed on what those are and the implications that they have for the healthy functioning of our democratic system?
Sure. So the folk theory of democracy is the democratic ideal. It's the idea that people should go out and do their research. That's the first step, is you go out and you research all the different political issues of the day. And you do so in an objective manner. So you look up arguments in favor of raising the minimum wage and arguments in favor of the death penalty, arguments against, and so on. And you do that for all the various issues. And then based on that research, and you try to objectively evaluate that research to the best of your ability, and then you come up with your policy positions. After researching all this stuff, I decided I'm for the death penalty or against the death penalty or for raising the minimum wage or not raising the minimum wage. And then you sort of have all these issues and your positions on these issues, and then you see how those line up with any of the given political parties. And so maybe you have 10 issues and you agree with the Republican Party on 8 of them, and then say, okay, I'm going to support the Republican Party. That is sort of how ideally it's supposed to work and how we're supposed to think through these kinds of issues. And, people like Jonathan Haidt have sort of talked about this is how the proverbial scientist thinks, right? You sort of gather all the evidence and then you draw your conclusions from that evidence. Unfortunately, that tends not to be how we think. We tend to subscribe to the tribal theory of democracy, and that really just flips the folk theory on its head. And rather than, researching things and developing policy positions and then arriving at the party that we're going to support, we start with our party first. And there's a great debate in political science about, are our party attachments related to, it's like the nature nurture debate, right? Is there something about our personalities that maybe lead us to become a Democrat or Republican? Or is it more nurture, how we're raised in a Democratic household, so we become Democrats. However we arrive at our party attachments, they come online pretty early in our lives. And once they're there, they stick. And so we start with our party identity, and then that changes everything. And so once we have our party, then we don't really do research yet. We simply ask, okay, what does our party believe about the minimum wage? Or what does our party believe about the death penalty? And then we, you know, okay, well, my party is for the death penalty, so I'm for the death penalty. And then, and only then, do we go out and actually start to do some research. But then, because we already have our party and policies in place, that research and that evaluation of evidence is skewed and heavily biased. And so that's where sort of selective attention and selective evaluation come in. We only seek sources of information that support our point of view. And if we are exposed to any sort of research or evidence that opposes our point of view, we'll selectively evaluate that information. We'll be hypercritical about it, be dismissive about it. And again, Jonathan Haidt would say that this is more like thinking like a lawyer. You start with your conclusion, this person's innocent or guilty. I'm going to selectively search for evidence that supports my case, and I'm going to dismiss or ignore evidence that doesn't. And we do this with politics all the time. And the implications for this, for democracy, are, there's a lot of implications. But what I think the biggest problem with subscribing to the tribal theory of democracy is that we hold policy views that aren't our own, and we aren't truly thinking. We have outsourced our thinking. We're letting our party do our thinking for us. And the essence of democracy is self-government. And I think when we think of self-government, we tend to think of going to the polls and voting on election day. And that is part of self-government. But I take self-government to mean something deeper too. Can we govern ourselves? And if we outsource our thinking to other people, we are not governing ourselves. We are not voting for ourselves. We are not thinking for ourselves. We're letting other people think for us. And that is the antithesis of democracy, where people are supposed to think for themselves and advocate for their own particular points of view. And so at the heart of it, I think the tribal theory of democracy is undemocratic, and that's why I'm so outspoken against it.
And with some people, it's not just going out and looking for the evidence that support their point of view, but they just completely take on the talking points of their party. Don't even give me any evidence, just give me the talking points. And I see that so often because I listen to various different news sources, and sometimes I will talk to people and word for word almost comes out what I've heard as talking points on some particular newscast.
Yeah. It's often been said, when we're watching particular newscasts or seeking, you know, particular political sources of information, that we seek ammunition and not information, or we seek affirmation and not information. And that's very true.
I think, you know, intuitively, a lot of us understand that, you know, this sort of extreme political tribalism is, you know, problematic, that it has consequences that, you know, aren't good. But, you know, really putting our finger on that, describing what that is in your book, you have sections on the toxic effects of extreme political tribalism. It covers stereotyping, discrimination, segregation, dehumanization. Can you give us some more detail on these sets of ideas and what we should, our takeaway should be from them?
Yeah, so political tribalism, I define political tribalism in the book as the attitudes and behaviors that derive from partisanship. And partisanship is the affinity that we have for our own party, or members, co-members of our own party. And what political scientists call negative partisanship, which is the hostility that we hold towards members of the opposing party. And partisanship, or the affinity that we have for our own party, really hasn't changed over the last half century. They ask people you know, political scientists ask people in surveys on a thermometer scale, which they have from 0 to 100, where 50 would be absolutely neutral. And it's trying to get a sense of how you feel about your party and members of the opposing party. And generally, it's been around 70%. If you ask Democrats or Republicans, how do you feel about other Democrats or other Republicans that within their own party, they feel pretty warmly, about 70 degrees. And then for members of the other party, it was generally around 40 degrees. But what has happened is that the affection that we have for members of our own party has been pretty consistent around 70 over, again, half a century. But that 40 degree score that we have given to members of the other party has plunged. And it's gone down below 30, approaching 20. And that is really where you see some of this negative emotion coming in to our political system, and a lot of this hyper-partisanship and tribalism and polarization and all of these things. And as you mentioned, there's sort of this parade of horribles that can unfurl from that. I'll just give you a couple of examples of each of the things that you highlighted. When we have negative views of their party, it's not surprising that we're going to stereotype members of the other party. And there have been numerous surveys that have found that Democrats have wildly inaccurate stereotypes of Republicans, and Republicans have wildly inaccurate stereotypes of Democrats. So, for instance, Republicans believe that around 38% of the Democratic Party is gay. In reality, it's 6%, right? Republicans vastly overestimate how much of the Democratic Party is Black, how much of the Democratic Party is atheist. And for their part, Democrats vastly overestimate how many Republicans are over the age of 65. So Democrats think about 44% of the Republican Party is over 65, when only about 21% of the party is. Democrats are vastly likely to overestimate how many Republicans are rich, meaning they make over $250,000 a year, how many are evangelical Christians. And we don't just stereotype who we think these people are and the demographic characteristics that they have. We also stereotype on issues. Democrats and Republicans vastly overestimate how extreme members of the other party are on a myriad of issues, immigration and even abortion. Democrats think Republicans are far to the right, and Republicans think Democrats are far to the left, when in fact you do have members of both parties who are on the extremes, but you have a lot of the members of the party who are more centrist and more in the middle, skewing a little bit to the right, skewing a little bit to the left. And if we stereotype these people and we have these sort of images in our heads of who they are, it's not surprising, and they're bad stereotypes, and it's not surprising that we would want to segregate ourselves from them. And that's been proven too. 31% of Democrats and 39% of Republicans have some or a lot of friends from the other party, which means most of us don't. And other surveys have shown that upwards of one third of both Democrats and Republicans would be unhappy if a member of the other party moved into their neighborhood. And if we're going to stereotype and segregate ourselves from members of the other party, it's not surprising that people would be willing to discriminate against members of the other party as well. There was a great study that was done by a couple of political scientists, Iyengar and Westwood. They just came up with different resumes, and they were basically the students were trying to get the student's going to try to get a scholarship, a $30,000 scholarship for college. And they were pretty identical in terms of all of their extracurricular activities and things like that. But it was evident that one was a Republican and one was a Democrat, because one was the president of the Republican Club and one was the president of the Democratic Club. And then the only other thing that they changed was the GPA, and they altered it depending on one of the students had a 4.0 and one had a 3.5. And what they found was, when they presented a resume to Democrats and Republicans, that they were more willing to give that scholarship or award that scholarship to the student in their own party, even when that student had the lower GPA. And so they took that as evidence that, you know, we will discriminate against members of the other party. And maybe most troubling is dehumanization. About 20% of Democrats and Republicans believe that members of the other party are not fully human. And the consequences of this If you don't believe that a fellow human being is actually truly human, then we tend to push them outside of our moral circle, and we feel as though we don't really have to extend certain rights to them. We don't have to treat them in a way that we would treat other fully human beings. And as a result, you start to see what political scientists call lethal violence, that Democrats and Republicans are increasingly willing to see or even inflict violence on members of the other party. And just a couple of numbers on that, 17% of Democrats and 7% of Republicans have said that they wish someone would physically injure politicians from the other side of the aisle. And 20% of Democrats and 15% of Republicans said the country would be better off if large numbers of the opposing party died. You know, one only need look at the headlines as of late in the last couple of years to see that, you know, these aren't maybe huge numbers, but they're tens of thousands of Americans. And all it takes is a couple people to go and cause significant harm, as unfortunately we have seen over the past couple of years.
Yeah, and as scary and depressing as that is, because we all do see that it does go on and hear it from maybe even some people in our own family and friendship circles. But for all of these things, Tim, that are going wrong, it seems like there are groups of people who are trying to do something about it. And so when I get depressed about it, I want to remember the folks that are working to make all this better. So I'm going to mention a couple here. For example, we've had Stephen Hawkins on episode number 68 of Thinking Clearly. He's the director of research at More in Common. And More in Common is a nonprofit organization focused on understanding the forces that drive us apart and working to bring us together to tackle our shared challenges. And then we had two episodes with different representatives from the organization Braver Angels. And we had on episode 57, Dr. Bill Doherty. And then on episode 66, we had Kieran O'Connor. He's the chief marketing officer of Braver Angels. And Braver Angels is a great organization. They have similar mission to bring Americans together, bridge the partisan divide, and strengthen our democratic republic, and get us talking to each other, getting us to reverse some of those stereotypes and misunderstandings that we have with each other just because we have some political differences. So have you had any contact with any of those organizations, Tim?
I have not had any formal connection with them or communication, but I do talk about Braver Angels in the book. I've watched a ton of their podcast episodes. I just finished a book by someone on their staff, Monica Guzman, about having tough political conversations. And your comment about having hope is so important. And I share that sentiment because I think when these problems start to crop up and as things have become more polarized and partisan, it really has mobilized people, people of good faith and people who want to improve the situation. And so you've got a lot of brain power working on this right now, and a lot of people creating organizations such as Braver Angels and writing books and talking about this and doing podcasts such as yourself and getting that word out. There's pushback now. And I hope that the more and more people that get involved in this and the more these ideas spread, you'll start to see people take heart. I believe that most people are people of goodwill. And yes, we'll have our disagreements and sometimes conversations can be difficult. But at the end of the day, I think that all of these efforts show that there is a hunger out there for this kind of work and a need out there for this kind of work. I'm thrilled at all of these organizations and what they're doing. And they're doing incredible work and it's having an impact, a positive impact.
In your book, in the section that kind of relates critical thinking to politics, in one section there, you discuss four possible outcomes and you use the term suitably sorted to represent the democratic ideal outcome. Outline that perspective for us and the implications that it has for a well-functioning democracy.
Well, I define a suitably sorted citizen as someone who has assumed the cognitive responsibilities of citizenship, but also the psychosocial responsibilities of citizenship. And the cognitive abilities of citizenship are essentially what we were talking about before when we were talking about the folk theory of democracy, that people go out, they objectively look for information, they objectively evaluate that information, develop their policies based upon that study, and then choose what party they'll support. That's tough work, and it's a lot of work, but that's only part of it. The other part of being a suitably sorted citizen is that you assume the psychosocial responsibilities, and that's sort of dealing with all of the social and emotional implications of assuming the cognitive responsibilities of citizenship. And so that it's another hurdle that we have to overcome to really become critically thinking citizens. And it's not easy. So if you are a Democrat who goes out and really researches, say, the nuclear power issue, and you come to the conclusion that nuclear power is important and that it's generally safe, and you are living with a group of people, your friends, spouses, coworkers, that are strongly against nuclear power, it's one thing for you to sort of come to this conclusion. It's another thing for you to actually admit that and talk to your friends and family and advocate for that point of view. If you're a Republican who believes in climate change and you're surrounded by other Republicans who don't, coming out and saying that you believe in climate change, you can risk friendships. You know, you can lose friends and family, and that's tough. And it's a lot easier sort of just to go along to get along. And so being a responsible citizen takes a lot of work and a lot of courage. And it is a big ask, but the implications for doing so are tremendously positive for our community at large. And if we assume the cognitive responsibilities of citizenship, for example, I think that candidates would start to put greater emphasis on policy details because we would be demanding more policy details. I think the media would start covering policy more than they cover the horse race. The horse race is the polls, who's ahead, who's behind, you know, who's doing well with this demographic, who's raised the most money, who's going to win that state or this state. They would start to focus more on policy because that's what we would want. And if we have our choices between media outlets and these folks are doing the horse race and these folks are talking about policy and we demand policy, well, they're going to have better ratings. And those other media outlets are going to start to react to that. If we assume the cognitive, you know, responsibilities of citizenship, I think those partisan news outlets will be marginalized because it will become a losing business plan. If we demand hearing both sides of an issue rather than one side of an issue, those sorts of outlets are going to go out of business pretty quick. Social media would become less toxic because we wouldn't, you know, give all of this attention to all the trolls. I think the spread of disinformation would decline because we would stop passing on this information. I think trust in mainstream media would increase, trust in government would increase. And ultimately, I think the result would be better policy, because better thinking leads to better politics. And that would be better outcomes for everybody. If we assume the cognitive responsibilities and then move on to assume the psychosocial responsibilities of citizenship, and we go out and actually, if you have a Republican who speaks out among their friends and says, you know, I actually think climate change is real, and here's why, and this is what I looked at, and these are the sources that I found, that starts to break down these stereotypes that we have about the different parties. It starts to break down this, it's the us and them thinking that all Republicans are the same and all Democrats are totally different and vice versa. We start to see similarities between the parties. We start to see some differences within our own parties. And as a result of that, I think a lot of the hostility that we have towards different parties, that effective polarization that we were talking about earlier, would drop. And we'd be less likely to stereotype, we'd be less likely to discriminate, we'd be less likely to segregate, we'd be less likely to dehumanize. And so I think the implications of actually trying to live by the folk theory of democracy and trying to be a suitably sorted citizen who assumes these responsibilities, it's huge. I think it has the potential to completely reshape our politics, our media, and everything that surrounds it.
on a previous episode of Thinking Clearly, our guest, Stephen Sloman, I think it was episode 14 for people who want to check that out. Stephen Sloman was co-author of The Knowledge Illusion, which focuses on the well-documented observation that when we're asked to explain how something works, including political issues and policies, we usually find that we know much less than we thought we knew about the issue. How do you fit this idea into the nature of our political opinions and what you call, we've been talking about, the responsibilities of citizenship?
The tribal theory completely distorts our search for evidence in the way that we evaluate evidence. The problem with that is we come to believe that we're very knowledgeable about an issue when in fact our knowledge is highly one-sided and skewed. It's not so much that we're not thinking. We are thinking. We're just selectively thinking. It's not that we're not doing research. We are doing research. We're just selectively doing research. So if I go out and, you know, I have a particular position on an issue because that's what my party told me to believe, and now I'm going to go out and selectively look for information, like I'm reading, I'm searching for information, I'm gaining knowledge on that issue, but it's going to be all one-sided. And as John Stuart Mill so eloquently said, he who knows only his own side of the case knows little of that, right? You have to truly understand and know about an issue, you have to look at it from both sides, all sides. And we tend not to do that. And the result is we will have really, really strong, strident positions on issues about which we know very little. And this is where Fernbach and Sloman came in with their research. And they asked people, what is your view on a host of different issues? I think they asked about cap and trade, flat taxes, the nuclear deal with Iran. And then people expressed these, he had Democrats and Republicans express these opinions. And then they asked him, how strong do you feel about this? And people are like, I feel really strongly about this issue. And then they simply asked them, okay, explain it. What is actually in the nuclear deal? How does a flat tax actually work? How would a cap and trade system actually be implemented? And people really struggled to answer those questions. And that is incredibly revealing, right? Because people expressed really, really strong beliefs and opinions about something that they really didn't understand. And this is an obvious result of the tribal theory of democracy. Because we start with our issue positions first and then go out and look for information. But it's just, as Bob mentioned earlier, it's just kind of like all these talking points. And we, it feels like we're thinking and it feels like we know something because we can sort of repeat and regurgitate these talking points, but we really don't truly know. And when I talk about this sort of thing, when I talk about the folk theory of democracy, one of the comments usually is that it's kind of unrealistic. And I don't disagree with that. We're incredibly busy people, right? We all have families and jobs and citizenship. Being a citizen is part of our identity. It's an important part of our identity, but it's only one part of who we are. And we don't have time to become policy wonks. We just don't. What I try to tell people is that's okay. You don't have to know everything about every issue. There's a lot of books that have been written about how quote dumb Americans are and how little they know about politics. And I think those are important books, but at the same time, I think they're a little bit jaded. Like we can't expect Americans to be policy experts on stuff, just like we can't expect Americans to be experts on medicine and be able to perform surgery on themselves or fix their own cars. We have experts to do that sort of thing. And we have experts who should craft policy for us. The people who really know the details of that policy. But it is our responsibility to either know enough about those issues to develop an opinion if we develop an opinion. And if we don't have the time to do that, then what I try to encourage people is then to just admit it, right? To be humble. And that's what Sloman's research really got people to do, is to recognize that you don't know. And that is okay, but don't go out pretending that you do know, and don't go out shouting at people and getting in arguments about these issues that you really don't know much about. And I think if we were just able to accomplish that, it would turn down the temperature a lot on our politics. And so I think their research is really important, and it plays a critical role, I think, in moving us forward, is just getting people to understand that just because you watch cable news at night does not make you a policy expert.
So maybe it's a matter of understanding it enough to identify the expert from the charlatan, maybe?
And realizing that you yourself are not the expert. And just being able to approach these issues with a, I don't know, I'm not sure. I think a lot of people are uncomfortable to be there, and I don't think we should. But I think for a lot of people, it's just, we assume that we have to have an opinion. And if we don't, we're sort of wishy-washy, or, you know, we're a flip-flopper or something like that. It's okay to not know. And it's okay to admit that. And it's okay to even just say, well, where my head at is today, what I have read, this is what I heard, but don't draw these like firm lines where we sort of commit ourselves to this position and then we're unable to change or unable to allow new information to change our points of view. And that's where it can get dangerous, because people sort of get locked into these positions and then it sort of becomes this existential fight when it really doesn't have to be.
In my view, the things that we're talking about here, partisan politics, has been going on way back, ever since our biological and cultural evolution hit on that winning trait of us becoming extremely social animals. And it was important for us to convince other people, persuade other people to gather support from the tribe. But with the current unparalleled power of the internet to efficiently organize us into networks of social groups, and even to exert control over our motivation, and I do like to call it instilling fear and loathing on planet Earth, we've jumped to a whole new level of polarization and partisanship. So give us your thoughts on acquiring, perceiving, and evaluating political information in the digital age.
I think that the internet can be both a boon for and the bane of democracy. And whether it's the former or the latter largely depends on us and how we interact with that technology. Take acquiring information, right? The internet provides us with more access to information that we have ever had at any other point in human history. When I was younger, and if I wanted to access a journal article, I had to go to the library, I had to go through the stacks, and I probably wouldn't even be aware of the fact that such an article existed in the first place to even go look it up. Now I can be on Twitter and I can see people posting information about, oh, this new study or that new study. And then I simply click on a hyperlink and it takes me to the study and I can read it right on my phone. That is remarkable. If we want to be a folk citizen and we want to search these issues, and I want to go say, you know, what really is the issue with minimum wage? Is it good for the economy? Is it bad for the economy? I can just go pick up my phone and find journal articles that argue yes or no, and I can read those journal articles. It's never been easier. And that is incredible. When you think about high quality news sources, I subscribe now to more newspapers than I ever have in my life, and they all come to my phone. And it's a cheaper subscription to my phone because they don't have to, you know, print them and that sort of thing. Although I do miss, you know, the days of holding a newspaper. It's an incredible resource right at your fingertips. Podcasts such as this, right? You can listen to podcasts on a myriad of topics. We never had that ability to do that before the internet. Even if you think about social media, and I know it can be incredibly toxic, but there are people on there of goodwill. I have met people through Twitter and had conversations with people on Twitter from different parts of the country with different political thoughts than I have, that I never would have had the opportunity to do that before. So there are so many wonderful ways in which we can acquire information online. Of course, because of our biases, we have to fight against that. That doesn't maybe come naturally to us. And so we tend to search for articles that only support rather than challenge our point of view. We will seek out websites and podcasts that we already agree with. And we will unfriend people who disagree with us. And we will only follow people that are the same ideology or share the same political points of view that we do. And it's the same with evaluating information as well. I look at the internet as this unbelievable opportunity for me to practice my critical thinking skills on a daily basis. When I log on, I can find a public opinion poll, right? Now, usually I may have heard of that public opinion poll in a newspaper or on the network nightly news. Now I get this opinion poll online. There's a hyperlink that I can click to, and it takes me to the entire poll, all of the questions they asked, detailed information about their sample, how that sample was drawn. And that every time is an opportunity for me to like practice again my critical thinking skills and look at these questions and ask myself, were these questions sort of objective, or are there any bias in these questions, how they were asked, the words that they're using, the order in which they're asking those questions? We never had opportunities to sort of practice that stuff before. And now we do. I think of images that we come across online. We can now do reverse image searches, right? Instantaneously online. We never used to be able to do that before. Before, if we came across a picture in a newspaper or something like that, we never would be able to determine for ourselves if they sort of made it a darker tint or cropped off a certain part of the photo. We can do that sort of thing now. It's at our fingertips. Again, unfortunately, we tend not to do that. And we selectively evaluate information. And one of the things that strikes me about some of the research done in this area about how we evaluate information, there's this incredible study. I talk about it in the book, but I would encourage people to look it up. It's an older study by Lord Ross and Leper, and it's about the death penalty. And I won't get into all the particulars of the research design, but basically they were asking people to evaluate a study. And it was a study on the death penalty. And they mixed and matched the results. And so sometimes the study said the death penalty is effective, it's a deterrent to crime. And other times it said the death penalty was not a deterrent to crime. And what was most fascinating is when people looked at this, they evaluated it in a biased manner, right? So if you are in favor of the death penalty and the study said the death penalty is a good thing, you were like, this is a great study. If it said the death penalty doesn't work, you were like, this is a terrible study. That wasn't surprising, but what's really surprised me is the quality of critical thinking that people engaged in when they disagreed with the study. And they didn't use the terms that we use in critical thinking, but they were essentially talking about things like regression to the mean. They were talking about outliers. They were talking about confounding variables. Now, again, they weren't using that language, but that's how they were critiquing these studies. And their critiques were right. It's not that they were off base. They were good critiques. The problem is they only do that when the study disagrees with them. If the study agreed with their point of view, they didn't do that kind of thinking. And so what I'm trying to encourage people in the book, and this was the driving force behind the book and why I made painstaking efforts to be nonpartisan in the book, is that we have to do this. We can think critically, but we have to do this when it's inconvenient. We are very selective in how we think. If you're a Democrat, I don't have to tell you to be critical when you're watching Fox. You're going to be. It's just going to come naturally. I've got to try to convince you to be critical if you're watching MSNBC and vice versa. And that's what I'm trying to get people to do. And if Democrats can start thinking critically about Democratic sources and Republicans can start thinking critically about Republican sources, we'll be in a much better place as a country.
We can't take on every issue and do that research, thorough research, and construct arguments and do formal critical thinking on every issue, but we can practice doing it on some issues, issues that we may think, I'm wondering, you know, I have kind of a weak argument on this particular issue, and I have not very much information on the background. Let me look into this one. So something that we get interested in, we can select that and practice this on it.
I always enjoy the conversations Bob and I have, most of all after our radio shows, most of the time. And it makes me think too, as you know, the responsibilities of a citizen in a social sense, that we could facilitate these conversations with each other. Maybe Bob is doing research into nuclear power and coming back and telling me what he found, and I can do research into transgender rights in bathrooms and come back to him and tell him what I found. Hopefully we can get there.
A critical thinking tag team.
Yeah, it is. It's a division of labor. And Hugo Mercer, he talks about that we are just biased thinkers by nature. And he says that the key to that, that isn't necessarily a terrible thing, as long as you're talking to other biased thinkers on the other side, because then you can sort of test your arguments together. We're a social species, and any sort of sharing of knowledge and division of labor, it's a wonderful idea. And because we can't do it all, but if we can come together in groups like Braver Angels, or even as Julia is suggesting, just a book club idea, but for politics, you know, and you do this issue and you do this, and let's come together and like kind of talk about it, but have people with differing perspectives on it. I mean, that's democracy, right? And that's wonderful. And that's how we learn. And that is critical thinking. And it's a wonderful idea. And again, I think there are groups that are trying to sort of encourage that sort of thing. And I hope they have success.
Yeah. And like you said, we can start every day in our own lives and with the people around us. You know, when it comes to political tribalism and polarization and, you know, the direction we're headed in, I can't, you know, help but think about the next generations. And as Bob mentioned in the introduction, you know, you teach various classes in high school. Bless you. It's important work there that I personally wouldn't sign up for. But how do you integrate, you know, these important ideas that you put into your book? You spend all this time and labor and writing and publishing this book because these ideas are important enough. How do you incorporate these sorts of things into your classroom teaching with young people?
I try to do it every day because I am so passionate about it. It sort of oozes out of all my pores. And so it's sort of inevitable. Some of the classes that I teach are more aligned with talking about some of these things. Obviously, I teach the AP government classes mentioned at the top of the show. And so I get to talk a lot about some of the things I touch on in the book about our partisan identities. Where do we get our party identities from? And then how does that impact and influence everything else, our thinking and so on? That's pretty natural. Some of the electives that I teach an elective on the 1960s in US history. And so a big part of that, we talk about the Kennedy assassination, and that's a wonderful opportunity that I can talk about conspiracy theories and certain biases that lead people to think about conspiracy theories or buy into conspiracy theories, confirmation bias, just world bias, cherry picking, correlation versus causation, like all of those sorts of things. And then I do a human rights course, and I talk about Holocaust denial in that class, which gives us an opportunity to evaluate claims that are being made by deniers, to talk about what is a quality source of information? Why is a quantity of information, of quality information, important, and so on? With a few of my colleagues, we started a critical thinking course. My school district has three high schools. It's actually a pretty large district. And so this class is running in all three schools. And every time we've run the course, it has been completely full at my school. And the kids love it. And there we do the whole gamut of critical thinking, everything, perception and argumentation and logic and logical fallacies, cognitive biases, what's a good source, what's a bad source, all of that stuff. I will find a way to fit it in some way, shape or form, because I think it is so important. And all of my colleagues do as well. In the more formal setting of the critical thinking class, it's a little bit easier, but we all do it in all of our classes. And there's a real hunger for it. And the kids really enjoy it. They get to challenge people, right? And they enjoy that sort of thing. And they get to look at, oh, we can look at this study or look at this poll and critique it. And maybe this person is wrong. And they love that stuff, because up to that point in their educational career, it's just sort of whatever is in the book is sort of gospel. And so they really, really take to this idea of thinking critically. Again, I think that kind of comes naturally. What I try to do in my classes is give those sort of natural instincts a name. This is what this is called. This is what that is called. But also I spend a lot of my time, because I think the hardest part about it is, again, turning that inward. Again, it's really easy to critique something we don't agree with, but make sure that you do that equally as well to people on your side or to your beliefs. That's the thing that is the hardest to get them to commit to. And I keep pushing that every day.
Boy, that warms my heart. Hearing you talk about what you're bringing into the classroom and how the students are responding gives me some hope. Well, for me, one of the strongest motivators for doing that extra work that we've talked about, that it takes time to be a critical thinker, is that science-based critical thinking offers the best chance to accurately assess reality, what's out there, how does the world work. And an accurate picture of reality really has an incredible advantage to our human survival and flourishing. What can we do to be more objective and accurate in our political assessments?
Well, it's a great question. I would say two things. One, be humble. As Richard Feynman said, the first principle is that you must not fool yourself, and you're the easiest person to fool. We routinely fall for the blind spot bias, where we think that other people are biased. Other people follow the tribal theory of democracy, but surely not me. I am not biased. I see the world as it is. I'm objective. I follow the folk theory of democracy. That's just not true. To be human is to be biased. And we have to recognize that. People who are politically active or interested in politics are most likely have strong party commitments, and that those strong party commitments will therefore distort how we see the world, how we seek information, how we evaluate that information. And we just have to acknowledge that and then try to correct it, right? And that's what I was talking about earlier about self-government, is we will have these biases and they will crop up, but are we going to let those tribal, inclinations govern us, or are we going to govern them? And I'll share a quick story. I usually do this, when I'm giving public talks on these topics, and it tends to resonate with people. And it is a very embarrassing story for me personally, but literally as I was writing the chapter in the book on false information online and evaluating false information online, and part of that chapter is about fake photos and how I tell readers how you can do reverse image searches and things like that. I have several group chats, text message groups, and I came upon a picture on Twitter that sort of pressed all my partisan buttons, pressed all my critical thinking buttons, because the particular person in this image was on the other political side than I am. And it was also like some numerology stuff that they seemed to be into. And I immediately forwarded it. And I sent it to one of my group chats with my colleagues at work. And as soon as I pressed send, I was like, you idiot, you didn't check it, right? And so now I'm in a panic, and I'm breaking out in a cold sweat. And I go and I do a reverse image search, and sure enough, it's fake, right? And then I look at the picture and I'm like, oh my God, of course it's like a Photoshop. And it wasn't even a very good Photoshop, And I was so embarrassed. That's going to happen. It's going to happen to a lot of people. We're not perfect. What I did at that moment was immediately went back to that text thread and I said, hey, everybody, I am so embarrassed and I'm so sorry, but I did not check this before I sent it. I just checked it and it's fake. Please do not forward to anybody else, and so on and so forth. And fortunately, I have some very kind and forgiving friends, but it's just like, here's this person writing this book about thinking critically in politics. And I did that, and it happens, right? We're human. The key is that what do we do going forward? And I struggle with this every day. I try every day, and I work really hard at trying to be as objective as I can. And I work really hard at trying to recognize my biases and doing what I can to correct them. And at the end of the day, that's all we can do. And if people are willing to do that, I think our political situation will be vastly improved. And part of that, being able to do that, is being humble. The second point, it's not just enough to say and admit that, hey, I don't really know as much as I think I do. That's great. But the second thing I would say is be curious. And it's not enough to sort of recognize that we don't know. We also have to have and encourage and stoke that passion to find out. Curiosity is a staple of democracy. We need citizens to be curious. We need citizens to go out and to want to know things and to research things. Again, you're not going to be a policy wonk, but go out there and try to find out and ask questions. Being right isn't important as getting it right. You know, it feels good to be proven right. We all love that. And that's why we sort of selectively evaluate information and selectively seek information. But at the end of the day, when we're talking about politics and we're talking about passing policies that affect millions and millions of lives, we have to get it right. It doesn't matter if it's a Republican idea or a Democratic idea. All that matters is it works. And that's what we mean when we talk about the experiment in democracy. It's about trying things and tinkering with variables and seeing if something works. Does this actually reduce poverty? Does this increase educational levels among our students? Is this better for the environment? Like, what works? That's all that matters at the end of the day, because that's what will improve people's lives. And I don't care whose idea it was. I just want to know, to the best of my ability, does it work? And does it make people's lives better? And we can't get there if we're not curious and we're not humble. And that's why I think this stuff is so damn important, because people's lives are at stake. And that's why we need to get it right.
Well, I do want to commend you on your book, Political Tribalism in America. I really appreciated how it was easy to understand and a good read, but also backed by a lot of data and research that wasn't overwhelming, you know, and I think that's a very tricky balance. So I look forward to whatever else may be coming your way.
Tim Redmond, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us, and thanks for your great work teaching our future voters, maybe even future political leaders, hopefully, to think critically and become responsible citizens. And thanks for writing that book, which I highly recommend. It's called Political Tribalism in America: How Hyper-Partisanship Dumbs Down Democracy and How to Fix It. Now, Tim, on our Facebook page, we're going to post links to your book. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post?
If you're interested in following me on Twitter, I could be found at TJREDMO, at TJREDMO.
Also, to those listening, I want to give you a big thanks for your interest in the topics that we discuss on Thinking Clearly. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.